minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is 1900 UTC Saturday, the 29th of April in the glorious future year of 2023, and I am speaking to you from Munich, capital of the Free State of Bavaria in southern Germany, and the place where in 1920 Edward Teller lost a foot as a result of being run over by a tram car. I mention this purely because we have someone listening who works at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, which was established as America's second nuclear weapons laboratory, purely because one laboratory wasn't big enough for Edward Teller's massive ego. I joke, of course. He was actually as brilliant as he thought he was, which most people aren't. Probably not even me. I'm sorry, lives near but doesn't work. My mistake. It doesn't matter. I'm reading things in calm anyway. But that's not what's important. What is important? Well, one thing that Jazzmass might be interested in, among others, is that I have just come from the Vintage Computer Festival Europe. Yes, Vintage Computer Festival Europe is held annually here in Munich. And I went earlier in the day. I bought a 3-day admission. I may go back on Monday. I don't think I'm going to go tomorrow. But mostly I went to look and see whether I might find anything to help me in my quest to turn a 1990s German payphone into a kind of video jukebox. And I didn't really. I did, however, see some pretty fun things, including a PDP 11/34 and a Wang computer, which was designed by a Chinese-American named Wang. It has no hidden meanings. Anyhow, and while I was there, I saw somebody load a computer program from punched paper tape, and the program turned out to be the classic Lunar Lander game. And someone was playing it and succeeded in repeatedly crashing by the usual trick of burning too much fuel at too high an altitude. And indeed, it appears that the Japanese company iSpace crashed their Hokuto R lunar lander in exactly that way a few days ago. JWH says his first programming job was for a Wang. Well, that's cool. So yeah, they had the Wang mini mainframe, I guess you'd call it, on display. That was interesting. But also while there at the Vintage Computer Festival Europe, I purchased a circa 1990 Soviet electronic dosimeter. I've got to get it open, put a 9-volt battery in it, and see if it works. We shall see. Not that I have anything really strongly radioactive here to test it with. But there were certainly a lot of very interesting exhibits, including an extensive exhibit on the history of Pong, with a Pong machine disassembled, so that you could see the various boards and see for yourself that there was no microprocessor. Anyway, so aside from the Hokuto R making the classic mistake of burning up all its fuel at too high an altitude and then smashing into the surface, and presumably the mission control console prints out, "Congratulations, you've just creamed a 26 megabuck lunar lander." By now, I'm sure everyone has heard that SpaceX's first attempt to launch the Super Heavy booster and Starship upper stage ended with a failed stage separation and the disintegration of the vehicle under the explosive charges of the range safety officer when the thing started spinning crazily. And I don't fault them for that. I mean, perfectly honest, the last time somebody launched a big heavy rocket with 33—heavier than the Saturn V— with 33 engines in the first stage, it didn't go too well for them either. Look up the history of the Soviet N-1. The first one obliterated its launch site, turned it into a smoking hole in the ground. American intelligence analysts were concerned that a volcano had suddenly erupted in Kazakhstan. And then it took them actually quite a while to get to the point of stage separation before blowing up. So I don't fault them too much for that. There are, however, two points which are somewhat concerning. The first, of course, is that they did severely damage the landing site, just in taking off. Now, looking at it, you know, considering, again, the history of the N-1, if I'd been in charge and somebody had come to me, one of my engineers had come to me and said, you know, we shouldn't build a big expensive launch pad for the first launch because we're probably just going to blow up on the pad and destroy everything within a kilometer. Let's build a cheap temporary launch pad instead. And if we ruin it, no big deal. And the damage pattern will tell us how we need to actually build the permanent launch structure. You know what? That's actually not a half bad idea. I'm not convinced that's what happened with SpaceX's launch site down in Boca Chica, though. Partly because I was looking at the launch video and the tank farm. Great big cryogenic insulated tanks full of liquid methane and liquid oxygen was way too close to the launch site. Way too close. And the other thing is that, yeah, they seriously damaged their launch pad. Again, no great loss. It's just concrete. But they seem to have succeeded in flinging chunks of concrete debris considerable distance. Again, I don't know if they damaged their tank farm or not. I'd be kind of surprised if they didn't, considering the other things they did damage that were farther away. And that, at least, seems to be partly a result. I don't have this 100%, but it's been suggested that they did not perform a 100% power test firing of all 33 engines clustered. And I realize the test stand they inherited from Beale Aerospace and MacGregor has its limitations, but there is a reason why we have Stennis Space Center. And that reason is the first time Wernher von Braun tried to fire a cluster of five F1 engines and the boilerplate Saturn V first stage, he broke a bunch of windows in Huntsville, Alabama. It's a German bureaucracy that likes a paper trail. Broke a bunch of windows in Huntsville, Alabama, so they said, okay, well, we clearly can't do this. We need to find some place which is on the way between Redstone Arsenal and the Gulf of Mexico, and there's nothing of any value there. And so they found an enormous tract of Mississippi swampland and built a test stand there. It's called Stennis Space Center. And, you know, shuttle main engines, all kinds of things get test fired there. And it's supposed to be available for non-NASA users. And I know that non-NASA users do use it. So the question is, did SpaceX ask to use the Stennis test stand and get told, well, it'll be a year before we can make it available to you? Or did they not ask? Because most people who've studied the N1, which again is a serious parallel to the SpaceX Super Heavy, most people who've studied the N1 agree that part of the problem with the N1 was that they didn't have a test stand where they could do full power static firings. And maybe I'm an old-fashioned fuss budget, but full power static firings sound like a real good idea to me when you're doing something new. Of course, the whole concept of the Super Heavy may be considered in some way flawed, right? I mean, firstly, SpaceX is already having trouble finding customers for the Falcon Heavy, which has like a third of the payload. Where are they going to find a customer for the Super Heavy? I don't know, right? I do know that what I want to do mostly involves lunar surface rendezvous, and the Falcon Heavy, the existing Falcon Heavy, does that just fine, or else Earth orbit rendezvous, right? And so here's the other sort of space launch that didn't quite go as intended news. So you probably heard that the European Space Agency had a successful Ariane 5 launch of the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer spacecraft known as JUICE. Bob Jonkman asked, can aesthetic-fired rockets be reused after firing? And the short answer is yes. I mean, sometimes you're test-firing a boilerplate, which is not a real rocket. So, you know, Von Braun's first Saturn V was made of welded steel, literally boilerplate, and would never have flown. I mean, you could have launched it, but it wouldn't have been any good. But liquid-fuel rockets are designed so they can be restarted numerous times, normally. And so, yeah, you take the actual flight vehicle, you set it up on the test stand, you fire the engines, you may even fire them for the full length of a flight, although that's not often done. It would be a good idea to do it before you launch the first one. You fire it until the propellants burn out to find out what happens. And then you take it and you ship it to the launch site and fill it up full of propellants again, and especially with the Super Heavy, unlike the existing Falcon series with their Merlin engines, which use a hypergolic ignition fluid, the Super Heavy uses an electric ignition system. And so there you don't even have to handle the nasty hypergolic fluids in order to restart the engines. But multi-start is a standard feature for liquid-fueled rockets. Indeed, even with the Delta IV Heavy RS-68, I think they are, engines, anyway, which have an ablative thrust chamber lining, those ablative linings are designed to last several times longer than the actual flight profile of the rocket launch, so that they can be test-fired repeatedly. Anyhow. But the important thing here is that the Jupiter Icy Moons orbiter is a really difficult job of design, right? So they launched it with an Ariane 5 rocket from Kourou, French Guiana, the way that ESA usually does, European Space Agency. And what they were really afraid of not working was the deployment of the solar panels. So this is the thing. Although they're going to Jupiter, where the sunlight intensity is very small compared to what it is here, and where there are intense radiation belts which seriously degrade any kind of semiconductor devices that are not heavily shielded, which of course photovoltaic panels by their very nature can't be. They have to be exposed to the surrounding environment. So they had to use a photovoltaic array for two basic reasons. First is that European Space Agency doesn't have access to radioisotopic thermoelectric generators. Now, RTGs were developed in Europe during the 1960s, and then those programs basically were scrapped. RTGs, in general, for space applications, use plutonium-238, and the problem with that is basically, the entire Earth's supply has been used up. It was manufactured. So plutonium-238 is not like plutonium-239. Plutonium-239 is made in industrial quantities, ton quantities even, By irradiating uranium-238 with neutrons. That's easy. In fact, you can't help doing it if you build a reactor fueled with natural or low-enriched uranium. Plutonium-238 is another thing entirely. When you use up uranium-235 in a nuclear reactor, some of it absorbs neutrons and doesn't fission. It becomes uranium-236. If you then put that uranium-236 back in the reactor, or just hold it there for a long time, it'll absorb another neutron, become neptunium-237, after undergoing a beta decay. If you chemically separate the neptunium, which the U.S. has historically done and the French have not historically done, so their neptunium is all locked up in waste, either in tanks of acid waste or actually in vitrified waste containers, which is not a good place for it particularly, but the U.S. has several hundred kilograms of separated neptunium still. And during the days of the nuclear weapons program, a sort of side thing that they did was to take the neptunium, fabricate it into targets, put those into the weapons production reactors at Savannah River. And that allowed the production of plutonium-238. Plutonium-238 is a pure alpha emitter, which decays to uranium-234, which is also a pure alpha emitter. Anyway, it's a great heat source that doesn't require a lot of shielding. So it was used in spacecraft, such as, of course, the Voyagers, right? And the Pioneers that went out to Saturn and beyond, and also in the heart pacemakers. Because it just doesn't require much shielding, which is important if you're trying to launch a spacecraft, obviously. And it was also used in the SNAP-19 and SNAP-27 RTGs that were used on the Apollo missions. And very small capsules of plutonium-238 have also been used as heat sources just for keeping spacecraft warm. Right. So, European Space Agency doesn't have these. Partly because they don't have their own RTG program, and partly because the last of the world supply of plutonium-238 went to Mars on board the Perseverance rover. Yeah, Mars 2020 carried the last of the world supply of plutonium-238 in a purity high enough to be actually used for this purpose. Now, thing is, there's been some work to restart production. And this is where the Canadian power reactors come in, interestingly enough, because Canadian power reactors, unlike most other power reactors, the CANDU, its moderator tank is basically at atmospheric pressure and room temperature. The only hot high-pressure components are the actual fuel channels themselves. There are channels other than the fuel channels, and you can basically lower stuff down into the reactor and irradiate it. And so U.S. Department of Energy has been working with the Canadians for some time to restart production of plutonium-238. But last I heard, there still wasn't enough of it, which is a great pity. Anyhow, now the British, who have large supply of americium, right? Americium is the product, americium-241, is the product of the beta decay of plutonium-241, which is a fissile material, but it has a short half-life. The British separated lots and lots of plutonium in the course of their nuclear power program because the fuel elements of their Magnox reactors had to be basically reprocessed fairly rapidly. They were uranium fuel elements, uranium metal fuel elements in magnesium alloy cans, and if you didn't reprocess them in fairly short order, the cans would start to break down, and nobody wanted to deal with that. Anyhow, so the British have large stocks of separated plutonium, and the separated plutonium, not having been reused in fast reactors, the plutonium-241 it contains, although the Magnox plutonium contains less of that isotope than pretty much anyone else's spent fuel, the plutonium-241 has had time to beta decay to americium-241. And so the British have been working on americium-241-based RTGs. Now, americium-241 decays to neptunium-237 again. Huh. Anyway, which is also a pure alpha emitter. So it's also in the running. It gives about half as much heat per gram as plutonium-238. But if you have it anyway, and you're thinking that you may have to chemically separate it from your stocks of separated plutonium just to avoid them producing inconvenient amounts of heat in storage, you know, it makes sense. But yeah, the ESA's Comet lander, you may remember from a few years ago, the Rosetta mission, Philae lander, you know, they landed on a comet and then their lander almost immediately died because it landed in shadow and literally froze before the comet tumbled enough to bring it back out into sunlight again. And if they had even, not even RTGs, but just the americium heat sources, it would have been saved. So that was really embarrassing for the Europeans. Anyway, they launched this JUICE probe, and it's got this stupid complicated flight plan. You know, so to get to Jupiter, there's a launch window roughly every 13 months for the classical Hohmann trajectory. The problem with the classical Hohmann trajectory is it takes a fairly high amount of energy. Launching on an Ariane 5, well, they had to have this great big bulky solar array, 85 square meters, which, as the ESA astronaut they were interviewing on the video said, that's bigger than my apartment in Paris. Anyway, so they had to have this enormous solar array, which accounts for something like half the mass of the spacecraft, maybe more. If they didn't have that, they could have boosted on a high-energy trajectory, and it would have gone straight to Jupiter. Instead, they have to do this very complicated multi-flyby pattern. You know, Earth, Moon, Venus, back and forth like a ping-pong ball several times, doing flybys to build up enough speed to then kick it out to Jupiter. So it's going to take 8 years to get to Jupiter. So you've got this spacecraft where it's got a lifetime of like 12 years. People have already been working on it for more than a decade. There are people who are, you know, their whole career, basically, is this spacecraft. And so they were holding their breath that the really elaborate deployment pattern of the 85 square meters of PV panels would work. And it did work, and everybody heaved a huge sigh of relief. But, as it turns out, they now have a very different problem. The key instrument, pretty much the central instrument of the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, is the Radar for Icy Moons Exploration, which is an ice-penetrating radar, which has a great big 16-meter-long antenna. It won't deploy. According to ESA's latest press releases, it's deployed about a third of its length, so about 5 meters, let's say, out of the total 16 meters. That's not great, because it means that the radar, the main instrument, is basically useless. Now, the communication antennas to communicate with Earth, those kinds of things, those deployed. Great. But the actual instrument, the ice-penetrating radar, it won't deploy. The assumption is there's a pin that's stuck, and what they're going to try and do is fire the control thrusters in a bunch of different ways to try and jiggle it loose. And if that doesn't work, nobody knows what they're going to do other than cry. Anyway, this reminds me very clearly about two things. Firstly, we're talking about a spacecraft with an 8-year travel time to get to its destination. A 12-year lifetime, something like that. But it all has to be designed around the first 8 minutes. Everything has to be packed into this little bitty box, which then has to stand up to 12 g's of acceleration plus and minus 4 g's of shaking. All our spacecraft, because they're launched from Earth, have to be designed around those first few minutes. And there's an obvious solution to this. You know, and I'm not saying this as me. I'm saying this as somebody who talked to somebody who published an article about this back in the 80s, people who've discussed it many times, right? It's very clear what the solution to this is. And the solution is these very big, complicated, expensive spacecraft that are the whole careers of dozens or hundreds of people. You don't try and stuff them into the nose cone of a rocket and launch it off the Earth. Instead, you take the individual parts, you pack them in bubble wrap, you put them in a spacecraft that's going to the International Space Station. There in weightlessness, you have the astronauts put the different parts together and jiggle it and make sure it's, you know, everything's in the right shape and so on. And then you attach it to a rocket, which gives it the much gentler boost out into its final trajectory. So you don't have to worry about these really elaborate one-time-use things that are intended to hold the PV panels in place against the stresses of launch, and hold the antenna in place against the stresses of launch, and so on, and so on, and so on. And none of this is new, okay? Back in 1970 or so, and I know this because I talked to the man, right? I mean, he told the story multiple times, but I talked to him myself about it. Al Bean was the astronaut office's liaison on the Apollo Applications program when they were working on the Orbital Workshop, otherwise known as the Skylab. And there was this solar panel deployment that had to be done. And Al said, why don't you make it a manual operation? It only has to be done once, and that way, you know, we don't have to worry about an automatic mechanism not working. The engineer said, no, we make it an automatic mechanism, and that way you won't have to worry about it. Well, of course, the Skylab launch didn't go right, and the solar panels didn't deploy correctly. And there was no manually actuable mechanism to deploy the panels. And so, Al Bean and Pete Conrad and the other guys had to get their heads together down in Houston, and then they launched the first Skylab manned mission with Pete Conrad and the other two astronauts doing the most hair-raising maneuver ever, using literally fiberglass fishing pole and a tree pruner that they bought in a hardware store in Houston. And so you've got one guy standing, you know, these three guys in space suits because they've had to depressurize the Apollo capsule. And one of them is sticking out the hatch. They've opened the side hatch, not the nose hatch, but the side hatch, sticking out the hatch, standing halfway out the hatch with his feet inside the spacecraft, being held in place by seatbelts, with the fishing pole with a tree pruner on the end, yanking on this nylon rope to get the bill of the tree pruner. If you are familiar with these things, it's a steel, two steel hooks sort of that mesh, like the beak of a parrot, and trying to snip this metal strap that's holding the solar panel in place, while the other two guys in the spacecraft are jockeying this multi-ton spacecraft with a little bitty boop, 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 boop of the reaction control thrusters to try and hold it steady and hold it in the right orientation with respect to the Skylab so that he can get the beak of the tree pruner over the strap, haul on the rope, and break the strap in order to deploy the solar panel. Oh my God! And of course, it only reminds me, I've got an issue of Aerospace Engineering magazine from the 1960, from the, like, 1964 or so. It's adjacent to the one with the one-way manned space program. I'm sure I've shown you that before. Anyway, in which the people who built the Orbiting Astronomical Observatory are talking about how amazing its automation is, and they end up with saying, and the automation is so powerful that clearly there's no role for man in space. The whole idea of manned spacecraft is silly. Well, when OAO was launched, it didn't succeed because of a fault that the whole spacecraft failed to work because of a fault that could have been repaired in 30 seconds by a man with a screwdriver. So, the lesson here is space is hard, but if you will pay attention to what has happened to people in the past, it doesn't have to be that hard, right? Learn lessons from your predecessors. If I have seen far, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants? Ring any bells? That was Isaac Newton, the guy who invented the concept of the orbital satellite. Okay, I've become overwrought. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll probably read them out over the air when I get back to the United States at the end of May. I'll probably also send you something nice. Support me, patreon.com/man_and_Adam, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, and coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. Don't miss it.